From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the program, a look at the Milwaukee Anthology, which features stories and poems from Milwaukee area writers.
Then Pardeep Kalika reflects on the life of his father, who was killed in the mass shooting at the Sikh temple in Oak Creek.
As much as we were trying to put a brave face on for the world because we felt the responsibility to do so, it was very emotional. I mean, emotional to the point that it was hard to reflect on some of these good and bad memories.
Plus, for the last 3 years, Milwaukee PBS host Joanne Williams has been chronicling a 1967 exchange between African-American kids from Rufus King and white kids from Kaukauna High School.
One of the goals with this film is to tell the story of the exchange and the play and make people think, maybe there is some hope. I didn't realize these things had happened, and look how well these kids got along.
Lake Effect is next, after the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. The DNC's decision to come to Milwaukee earlier this year set off a lot of stories that beg the question, who are Milwaukeeans? While there are many view from the middle narratives by national media outlets, the voices from actual Milwaukeeans have been frequently compressed to sound bites.
In some ways, the Milwaukee Anthology is a response to these outside voices asking who we are. The book features stories and poems from a wide array of local writers, and each piece paints a different part of the overall picture of Milwaukee, a place that is home, whatever that may mean.
Justin Kern is the editor of the new collection by Belt Publishing, which focuses on work from and for areas in the Rust Belt. Kern spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers and started by explaining the impetus for the anthology.
Belt, they're out of Cleveland, great indie publisher. They had started this kind of series of real earnest looks and kind of challenging, artistic, heartbreaking, awesome looks at cities in the Great Lakes Rust Belt area. And I think it ramped up in particular around and after the 2016 election. You know, there's always the kind of proclivity, I think, every presidential election cycle for either coast to try to summarize who a voter is from outside of Cincinnati or outside of Racine, or, you know, there's like this ideal that it feels like they try to mold, which is completely outrageously wrong. So anyway, I mean, it's not completely tied to that, but they had some great traction, I think, just because those stories were – people were hungry for those stories. People wanted to hear what life actually was like in Flint, what life was like in Buffalo, in Pittsburgh, in Cleveland. And I had submitted a piece – for the Buffalo anthology a couple of years ago, which they gratefully they ran. And working with them on that and another piece in a different anthology, I had a couple of weeks off in between jobs about 15 months ago and said, hey, what about a Milwaukee one? And they said, yeah, how about someone – do you know anyone that would do it? You know, I've written. I never edited or arranged a book before, but they were extremely patient and gave great like guidance and kind of guidelines to how to pull it all together. And, you know, being in Milwaukee since 2005, I had a pretty good idea of the stories that we had heard enough of. You know, I think we know that we have fried cheese curds and we have motorcycles here. You know, those things are cool. They have a place. But there are a lot of other amazing, diverse, interesting stories going on in the city, especially right now.
You know, you mentioned you're originally from around the Buffalo area,
yes.
Western New York.
Yep.
And as we talked about a bit before the conversation, Milwaukee, like, really makes you prove that you're a Milwaukeean. There aren't a lot of people who aren't born and bred here who are quick to say, oh, yes, I'm a Milwaukeean. What do you feel like? I mean, you have been here for more than a decade. What do you feel like made you specifically qualified to edit this kind of anthology?
I think, you know, since I've been here since 05, I'm a homeowner now. You know, I feel like I've maybe put in my time with work and paying taxes and going to awesome corner bars. So, you know, I feel like I've put in a little bit of the time there. And I have a pedigree as a writer. I've been a writer and editor for all my working life. But you're right in that way where there is something where, you know, from there's maybe an hour and a half radius around Milwaukee where that's where most of the people from Milwaukee are from. It might be somewhat of an overgeneralization, but, you know, I think Mayville is like, the, you know, the, that's like That's the Outer Banks. The feeder, yeah. Whereas like a lot, you know, essentially all of the Midwest is a feeder to Chicago. You know, Milwaukee gets like Monroe, gets Mayville, gets Racine. So there is a quality to Milwaukee where an outsider both gets to maybe see the city in a way that everyone that has spent all of their life in the 414 might not see some things. But also, I had to go out and learn more about the city. I had to go learn about neighborhoods on my own, maybe in a way where I didn't have the rites of passage of, having a car ride when you're 16 all the way up North Avenue from downtown all the way out to the suburbs, you know, that kind of thing. So there is some quality of having had to learn. And I think people here are extremely social and like want you to be here. But there is kind of like a sideways glance when you say you're from like any farther than that hour and a half radius, you know. And it goes both ways, I think, too. Michael Perry has a great piece in the book that kind of breaks down some of the walls on this idea that Milwaukee and Wisconsin are these like two different planets when we're really the same planet, maybe orbiting within ourselves or something. But I don't think that we're all that different in the state, but there is that kind of, at least the initial, you know, with a lot of people, you know, it's, oh, you're from Milwaukee. Or like you were saying earlier, oh, you're from Lake Geneva. Like there's, you know, there is a thing where people, there's a second of consideration, and then usually you're, you know, hopefully welcomed in.
When I first told people, oh, I'm from Lake Geneva, a lot of people would say, oh, well, that's basically Illinois, right?
Right.
Not really. I would also argue that like that part of Illinois is a little bit like Wisconsin, northern Illinois.
It's really blurry, that state line area, for sure. For sure.
Yeah.
Especially when there's like a big lottery ticket sale or something.
then it becomes very blurred. Everyone's a Wisconsinite or an Illinoisan.
Yeah, when it comes to the Powerball.
So, you know, you talked about learning about Milwaukee as an adult as opposed to kind of learning it just by being here.
Yeah.
At the same time, you know, I was reading one of the pieces that talks about a series of bus tours that Adam Carr has been doing.
Yes.
That teach people about the city they think they know but don't really. You know, when you were digging into these stories, what did you learn?
Yeah, Lauren's piece on the kind of redlining bus tour is really remarkable. And that's been continually an eye-opening thing to me, is how the city, the structures, the powers that be, you know, in just aspects of history, have made it so that it's people are just almost sequestered to their neighborhoods or feel that way. And there's, you know, two aspects to that, obviously. But in particular, to kind of Lauren's story, that certainly touches on a thing where I feel like this city makes it far too easy for people to just be in their neighborhood, for people to just, or makes it too hard to get out of your neighborhood. And, you know, those things aren't complete mistakes, that sometimes that's through history, through the powers that be, whatever the situations are. Certainly segregation plays a huge factor in that, and that's mentioned throughout the book. But that, to me, was the learning experience of like getting out and experiencing those neighborhoods for yourself, being proximate to all the challenges and interesting, cool things going on everywhere in the city, to have it be a point of civic pride that, I can't sit back and let it be okay that a certain neighborhood is just the bad neighborhood, or like a certain you just aren't supposed to go to a certain neighborhood, or a certain neighborhood is just like for certain people. Like that's unacceptable. And I think as far as like in terms of civic pride, I think we, you know, as Milwaukeeans, we need to see it more holistically. But that's certainly like exploring those neighborhoods is something that, like, not that there are big themes in the book along the lines of kind of that exploration, but I do think a number of the authors touch on it, including Lauren's piece, including James Causey's piece. And I think it opens up an opportunity for us as Milwaukeeans to have a conversation about where we go, where we spend our time, where we spend our money, and who we consider our neighbors, because we're all in the same city together.
It is hard to have really any conversation about Milwaukee without including segregation. It's certainly something that I think all of us producers on Lake Effect, we have struggled with at points, like, when do we keep bringing it up? When do we need to, you know, pull that back and talk about other things? Because it is so integral to the city. In that same kind of light, you know, this book doesn't really silo things. It doesn't go, you know, this neighborhood, this neighborhood, this neighborhood. It is a more holistic look. What were the kinds of stories that you really wanted to tell through this book, and maybe some of the stories that were really important to not overlook, I guess?
I didn't want it to be full of the tropes of what Milwaukee is or the stories that are out there abundantly. We didn't need another book on that kind of thing. We didn't need another book to explain Summerfest. You know, if you dig Summerfest, you know, that's great. There's plenty of ways to figure out and explore and experience Summerfest. But I think one of the things I certainly sought out in the call for submissions and in the people that I reached out to myself was to make sure that Milwaukee, the actual range of diversity was on display. And I think the book does a pretty good job with that. Of course, we could do better. And I wish there was more space for more stories in there. But we were limited by it being a physical thing, which is a weird concept in his own right nowadays. But it was important, certainly in pulling the book together, to make sure that there were the voices of Mariela Munoz Goñez, who kind of talks about being from El Salvador, but growing up in Milwaukee, but, you know, still making pupusas and her husband's Bolivian and kind of that experience in Milwaukee. I think that's an experience we don't hear enough of. The experience of Fifi Jaber, a Reagan High School student who kind of talks about these speech competitions, but also weaves in what it's like to grow up Palestinian in the south side of Milwaukee. So, you know, just two examples, I think, of the kind of idea that Milwaukee, we are a super diverse city. And there are challenges of segregation that, you know, I don't want to, like, hand wave at. But we have incredible opportunities because we are a big city. We're not just we're like the big town or small city or whatever they want to say. But this is a diverse place with a lot of opportunities to get to know a lot of different type of people.
When you think of the typical reader of this anthology, I imagine it will be a lot of Milwaukeeans. It may also be people who are coming here for a variety of reasons, for the DNC, for example, trying to see, instead of the kind of view from the middle that we get from the East Coast, the actual view from people who are in the middle.
On the ground, yeah.
On the ground. Who do you view as your audience, and what do you hope they get from these stories and these poems?
Yeah, I appreciate that question. It is twofold. You know, I learned a lot in the submissions, in the wave of submissions that came in, and working with the respective authors in the book, I learned a ton. You know, so I hope it's a chance for people to see and consider their city in a different light, and maybe even be inspired to learn more, to go out and find the range of information sources that are out there that are about our city, that are about our state. So there's that opportunity, of course. But we are in a spot where, like, you know, there's like two, maybe three championship sports teams. So all these like national TV cameras are going to be here. And, you know, hopefully more than just the kind of passing shot of, you know, someone making a cream puff at state fair during a, you know, baseball game, that there'll be people coming to experience Milwaukee, and there'll be kind of a national lens. The DNC is going to be here, of course, and that'll be – I don't even know if the city's really prepared for the kind of mania and just wild wave of people that are going to come here for that, because, again, Milwaukee's not the place that, you know, is set up typically as a destination. But that doesn't mean it shouldn't be, and we can't be super cool and show off all the amazing things we have going on, including motorcycles, including cheese curds, but, you know, including inviting people to go to Washington Park, go to Havenwoods for the kind of like the jazz and blues thing they have over the summer. I mean, there's so many opportunities across the entire city that's my hope, is that, you know, for those outsiders, that it's one of many voices that they take advantage of of hearing, of reading, of learning about. And one small, like, conscientious thing that I made, decision I made in pulling the book together, too, was that I didn't want it to be a thing where it was, like, the Milwaukee literati. Like, I didn't want it to be, like, all of the same writers. There are some completely baller, great writers in here that names that people will know, like Matt Cook, Dasha Kelly. But there are a lot of voices in here that, you know, they're central and integral to the book because they offer a different perspective, more than that they're a professional writer or something like that. They have a distinct story and viewpoint that has great value.
Well, Justin, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and speaking with me today.
Thanks for the conversation. It was great.
Justin Kern is the editor of a new collection of stories and poems called The Milwaukee Anthology. There'll be an event with some of the authors on the 24th. There's more information at WUWM.com. Kern spoke with Joy Powers.
Coming up, a look back at a conversation with one of the writers featured in the Milwaukee Anthology. Pardeep Singh Kalika joins us to talk about his father, who was killed in the shooting at the Wisconsin Sikh Temple. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
We are back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. More than 6 years ago, a white supremacist murdered six people at the Sikh Temple of Wisconsin in Oak Creek. Among those who died in the terrorist attack was the temple's leader, Satwant Singh Kalika.
His son, Pardeep Singh Kalika, has tried to live up to his father's philosophy. He works with Serve to Unite, an organization that teaches tolerance to young people. He co-authored a book with a former white supremacist named Arno Michaelis, and his writing is also featured in the Milwaukee Anthology.
Last August, Pardeep Kalika joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to talk about his father's life, which began in a rural village in the Punjab region of India. Satwant was a farmer, but difficult times led him to move to America with his wife and two young sons. Pardeep Kalika discusses what it was like for his family when they moved to Milwaukee.
My father decided to move, and I mean, he was very reluctant to move because he was a farmer. And in our culture, farming is sacred. And so he was reluctant to lose that part of himself. That he thought that he was going to have to lose because, he knew that farming wasn't something that he could probably do in the States. We had very little family at that time. This is in 1982, 81. Milwaukee was a manufacturing town, and he knew that he was moving here because he was going to move by his older brother, who was a veterinarian. My mom graduated from the fifth grade, and that was her highest grade level that she attained. Very typical of that time, even in rural India, for women for girls to stop school around fifth grade and really just concentrate on homemaking. And my father, he was a farmer. So their reason for moving here was just for a better life and opportunity. And it speaks to the time right now, is that when we're having these discussions on immigration and why immigrants move to certain places, I think his story is very typical in that where anybody that's coming to America is typically coming here because they want an opportunity at a better life than the one they had where they were at. And my father was no different.
So your parents, load all of you and your brother on a plane, moved to Milwaukee. What were some of their biggest adjustments to living in America? You're living in different places, a whole different culture. You have a completely new landscape. What was it like in those early days?
It was difficult. They worked for not much and quickly realized that there was no way to sustain living just one income. And so my mom had to go back to work. And I remember at that time I was probably about 6 years old, six or seven. And my younger brother was 4 or 5 years old. And it was really kind of up to us to watch each other's back. It was just a struggle and a battle to not only just make it in Milwaukee, but, the culture of Milwaukee was also shifting at that time. And there was a lot of jobs that started to leave town. And that left a vacuum for now you're replacing manufacturing legitimate income jobs for, you know, an illegal economy, kind of just a, because you couldn't survive. And I remember growing up trying to find places that were safe. So we moved around quite a bit from neighborhood to neighborhood to neighborhood to neighborhood. And both my mom and dad were working. My mom was trying to learn English so she could get a job. And we would spend a lot of time at home just kind of watching TV and at the mercy of watching reruns of different shows and really not seeing faces that were similar to ours be anything. So idolizing those that did not look like us, it was difficult because then you're losing a little bit of yourself and your culture. And at that time, I mean, it was kind of common. People called it the melting pot. And it sure was, you know, a melting pot at that time, as you lost a lot of yourself. And I just remember early on just really being, it being difficult, making friends in different places and trying to adjust. And I mean, I can look back at it now and say, okay, well, that was a blessing to be able to meet different faces. But at that time, I would oftentimes miss some of the friends that I would leave at the old apartment. And we went from the north side to the northwest side, to the west side, to West Dallas to South Milwaukee, to Oak Creek. And really, like, this whole journey has basically got me to the point that it's like, if we don't start to invest in all the neighborhoods that exist, we can't segregate violence. If we don't start to invest in all areas and start to see ourselves within an entire city, state, nation, no place is safe.
You mentioned you felt as if you were losing part of yourself. You're kind of living in split worlds, you know, still trying to connect and identify with American culture, yet at home you have the strict upbringing as well. One memory in your book relates to your father deciding to cut yours and your brother's hair after being bullied so badly in school for it. How did he come to that decision, and what do you think it's showed about him and his sacrifice and commitment to trying to establish this new life for all of you?
Yeah, that's a great question, Audrey. I know that it was a difficult decision for him. He was a very spiritual man, and anybody you talk to in town, he could basically read a passage and memorize a passage and tell you the passage. But he also was empathetic to the suffering of his children. He saw that we were coming home and we were crying and we were, you know, telling people that people are, and what we had at the time were Judas. At that time, the man bun wasn't a popular thing. And this was very much likened to a man bun covered by cloth. So people will go around and really like just tap you on the top of the head and, you know, and liken it to a buzzer in Jeopardy. Then asking you questions like, what is under there? Well, it's my hair. If only girls wear hair like that. And so all of this was just kind of commonplace. So we would go home and he wrote in his journal that was one of the hardest days of his life, was to take us to the barbershop and have our hair cut. And I remember it was my brother's hair that he got cut first. I remember being a little bit envious of, like, why did he get to assimilate faster than I got to assimilate? Now that I look back at it, it kind of makes sense. He was trying to hold on and do it. Like, he couldn't take it all at one time.
It's kind of a testament to something so deeply important to him and his religion, and yet having to make these sacrifices and adjustments for the sake of making it a somewhat more tolerable experience. Yeah. Do you think your parents or father recognized that through this new life, you know, even though you kind of had to play both roles, hide the music you were listening to, or yeah, the friends you were hanging out with, or the girls you were dating who weren't Indian. Do you think they saw this as, later on, just a strength that was added for you and your brother, that you got to have these dynamic experiences, even though it was hard for you growing up to have such a strict household, but yet outside of that household, it's a different American culture?
Yeah, no, Audrey, it was hell. Growing up, it was literally hell because you wore different masks. You wore an at-home mask when you were like, okay, well, let me just be kind of traditional and I'll talk, you know, we'll talk this way and we'll talk that way. And, you know, out in public, it was kind of wearing this other mask of, well, I'm a boy, man growing up in this culture. And now I got to be hard and I got to be tough and I got to blend in. And yeah, and dating was just, it was difficult as well, because there was, you couldn't tell your parents that I was dating someone. So I don't think they really thought of it as a strength at that time. They would have been like, you're trying to be too American. These kids don't know our culture. And it was just, you're caught in between different things. And now that I look back at it, say, okay, you know what? Some of what happened on August 5th was really reminding me to say, okay, you know what? You need to take your own voice back, whatever that voice is and whatever you're meant to be. You need to come back to that and take that voice back, because there's value in your culture being part of this culture.
You could, I suppose, say that your father was that centering force, that constant reminder of this is your culture, this is who you are, where you came from. But how does his demeanor change towards you as, you know, you grew up and your relationship changed, you know, from childhood to teenage years and all the discipline and the hell that you went through to adulthood leading up to his death? You know, how did you know that he cared and loved and respected you?
Vice versa, you know? Yeah, no, so it was really, I mean, it was a journey with both my mom and my father. But for that part of, like, just knowing that somebody loved you, my mom was very much more nurturing than my father was. My father was the type, and I didn't understand this later, but he would kind of show you. I look back at it and it makes complete sense now as a 42-year-old man who has children of my own. But at the time, each time I used to leave home for an extended period of time, like if I went to college, the day of, he would get into a heated argument with me. And I was like, why is this pattern always like, as soon as I'm about to leave, he gets into this really just argumentative state of mind where we're both lashing out at one another. And over time, I realized that was his way of showing me that he was going to miss me. And he had to, like, prepare himself to be able to miss his son. And it's just a weird culture of masculinity that we were trying to navigate. But later on in life, once I had my own children, he would just do things, and these things would be just simply random. I would come home and I would see him picking the weeds out of the flower bed. And now you have the 60-some-year-old man who's doing this, and he's kind of gleaming over at you and saying, okay, I see you haven't done this. So there was this part of, like, you haven't really won this fight. And for sons getting out of the shadow of their fathers, I think that there's always some fight. And he would just every once in a while do things to say, you know, the shadow might not be as bad as you think it is. My final day that I spent with my father was just a beautiful day. And it was August 3rd. It was my birthday. And this is 2 days before August 5th. So the last time that I saw my father, he was giving piggyback rides to our children. And he was just happy being a grandfather. He was always, because of how he grew up, and he didn't have a welcoming sort of culture for him to come into. His vision was to create that and create a community that other Sikhs could come to and worship with and assemble with and share, like just be welcomed, so that they don't have to sacrifice some of the culture that we had to sacrifice. But you know, he was very content where he was on August 3rd. And I could tell. And then just later on, we drank a little bit more and played with the kids. And there was this genuine, like, I respect the way that you did things, Dad. And I know that you respect the way that I'm doing things. And that would be our final sort of memory together. And it was a great one.
Your father had a favorite saying, work is worship, and you mentioned that farming was sacred work for him as well. And throughout his life, after he established himself here in Milwaukee, was building businesses, building the temple, and you mentioned he had this truck forever. Like, no matter how well he did or anything, like, he constantly rode that truck or was doing repairs himself, things like that. You know, do you think that was kind of a good example of who he was like kind of the character that he kept this truck around and just did everything by himself, no matter how good things were going.
No, it definitely was. He never bought a new car. And at some point, he had gotten to the point where he was financially capable to buy a new car or a house or, you know, what you name it. But he was financially capable of doing that. But he had so much of that humility from when we didn't have money that he would definitely do everything on his own. Whatever he could do, he would do on his own. That truck was actually a gift that I gave to him. It was beautiful. It had an 8-foot bed. Which is perfect for like drywall, flooring, and all kinds of things, right? And so that truck is still, I mean, it's still in our family now, and it keeps running and keeps running and keeps running. But he was the type that he would work himself to sleep. There was times when he would be jackhammering, and now this man is 170 pounds. He's really wiry. And super strong for like the size that he was, and he would never give up. He was like that, that wiry sort of fence that like you just can't cut. It's like it's like almost a pain in the ass. But he would outwork you. He would outwork you. And there was days when he would work himself so hard that he fell asleep for 3 miles, and you get home and he's collapsed out again, taking ibuprofen. But he wanted to push you.
I imagine, of course, it's a somber time, but as the years pass on, you know, does your reflection of your father change with every anniversary?
Yeah, it does. Early on, I think as much as we were trying to put a brave face on for the world because we felt the responsibility to do so, it was very emotional. I mean, emotional to the point that it was hard to reflect on some of these good and bad memories. And, you know, when somebody loses somebody in that capacity, there's this sense of processing that needs to authentically happen. And for us, yes, we put, you know, but we were gritting our teeth through a lot of that. We were still mourning. We were still thinking that the world is unfair. Everybody is out to get us, against us. So there's this anxiety with it and all types of feelings that you have wrapped up in, you know, your emotional skin that you're processing through. So over time, it has very much become a journey of authentic healing. And it changes now because now, since his death, my wife at that time was 7 months pregnant. And my youngest two boys had never seen their grandfather, but they speak as if they know him. And they speak as if he's a friend. And I think there's something spiritual within us and within our DNA that lets them know and feel that he's still there. And there's mannerisms that they have that I know that they haven't picked up by seeing him move around, but they just have to be genetically encoded. And there's things that they say that he would have said. And there's this sense of, I guess, in myself, the sense of contentment and gratitude towards life being that way, that we can get to a point where we can really spiritually heal because we know that the person is not dead but has transitioned.
What would you like listeners to take away about your father and in their own reflections as this anniversary comes up?
Yeah, and I hope that people think about their own loss and their own story. Your story is an honor for someone to hear, and it's going to help somebody, and it really needs to be cherished. Over the past 6 years now, I have been inundated with stories of people suffering and stories of people's pain and you know, almost every type of mass shooting you can think of, from survivors from Columbine to Sandy Hook to children that grieve for their parents. And what I've learned throughout that time was, if you value that people share their story, then you can work through your own pain. If it's a burden for you to hear other people's stories and journeys and suffering, then somehow, some way, vicariously, you pick it up, because we're not honoring pain. And overall, I think this country needs needs to really accept and honor the pain of the past so that we can really heal going forward.
Pardeep is the eldest son of Satwant Singh Kalika, the president of the Sikh Temple of Wisconsin, who was murdered in the mass shooting that took place at the temple on August 5th, 2012. He spoke with Audrey Nowakowski last August.
Kalika is also a writer whose work is featured in the Milwaukee Anthology. His story talks about the shooting and how it impacted his life. You can hear more conversations with him at WUWM.com.
We will take one more break and then chat with Milwaukee PBS host Joanne Williams about a film project that she's been working on for the past 3 years. You're listening to Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Among the many stories featured in the Milwaukee Anthology is one by Joanne Williams. Many of us know her as the host of Black Nouveau on Milwaukee PBS, and she's also the driving force behind a documentary called Kokana and King.
The film documents a tumultuous time in U.S. history, the 1960s. From Vietnam to civil rights, things were changing, and it was in the spirit of integration and inclusion that an exchange between students from Rufus King High School in Milwaukee and Kokana High School in Kokana, Wisconsin, took place in 1966. It began with a play called In White America, and more than 50 years later, the story is still not done.
Williams graduated from Rufus King in 1967, and she remembers the play and the student exchange, although she didn't participate in either. She did stop by the studio in March, though, to talk about the documentary and to give us the background of the story.
There was a teacher at Kokana High School. His name was Thomas Schaefer, and he did plays. But he wanted his kids to have a broader view of the world. So he wanted them to do that by performing in a play. The play he chose was In White America, which is the history of African Americans from slavery to civil rights. But in Kokana in 1966, he was, as I say, demographically challenged. There were no black people. So he, through another teacher who taught at Kokana, Bernie Hupperts, met a teacher in Milwaukee at Rufus King High School, Ruth Thomas. And they said, well, we'd like to do this play. How are we going to do it? And they figured out that they would have an exchange. So students from Rufus King went up to Kokana and lived with families for a month and did the play. And then students from Kokana came down to Milwaukee and lived with families for a month and did the play. And this was 50 years ago. It was during the civil rights era. So my charge to myself was, when I realized that it was 50 years ago, which I realized in my garage in 2016, when I was going through some old papers from high school.
And that's right, because you were a Rufus King grad.
Yes, I graduated in 67. I found this copy of the King's Page, the student newspaper, which had the story of the kids coming from Kokana on the front page. And of all the high school newspapers that I kept, that was the only one I could find. And I remembered that I thought this was pretty interesting. So I said, I'm going to tell this story. So I tell people that the story has been with me for 50 years.
Well, it was.
Yes.
Absolutely. And when you started thinking about how you were going to tell this story, what were you thinking? Were you thinking a documentary initially, or were you thinking more of a feature film? Or
yes.
Yes, both?
Well, I'm a television person. So first I thought it would be a nice television documentary. Maybe 30 minutes. And as I started researching it and trying to find these students who were part of the exchange, I said, this is bigger than that, and decided, all right, I'm going to make a documentary film. I'm not going to limit the time. I'm just going to find what I need to make it and then make it. So it's taken me since about May of 2016 to today to find the students. There were 13 exchange students. I found 8 of them, which statistically is pretty darn good. I'm focusing on 4, 2 white, 2 black, 2 males, 2 females, 2 from King, 2 from Kokana. Then there's some other people who will be in the film. And I said, I want to tell the story of their exchange, what it was like for them as 17 and 18-year-old kids to participate in this, not only in the exchange, but in the play. The play was very controversial. It was written in 1963 by Martin Duberman. And it's a documentary play. It's not a play with a story with a beginning and middle and end. It's a play of actual documents, diary entries, congressional testimony, speeches, conversations between people that were documented. So these are the actual words of the people who are portrayed in the play. And then there's the exchange itself. What was it like for these high school kids to live in each other's homes and live in different communities? The kids from Kaukauna lived in a very small community. It was 8,000 to 10,000 people in 1966. It's 10,000 people now. And then what was it like for the kids from Milwaukee to go up to Kaukauna and live in a small community? We talked about that. And during the course of research, I went to Rufus King to find out how I could locate these students. We dug through old records. We dug through identification cards that were used in 1966 in a file box to try and find these students, and went down into the caverns of my alma mater, which is Rufus King, to find the 1966 yearbook. But I also met the theater teacher at Rufus King, whose name is Erica Alamein Renk. And she had never heard of the play, never heard of the exchange. Nobody has. And she said, I want to do the play again. So 50 years later, in 2016, the play was restaged at Rufus King High School with a multi-ethnic cast. And when she said, I want to do the play again, I got very excited and said, good, we're going to shoot all that. And then I was thinking, I wonder, since this is 50 years old, if the playwright, when it was revived in New York, which it was revived in 2013, I think, if he wrote anything to go with it, like a foreword or a commentary or something. So I thought, how am I going to find Martin Duberman? So I called around to some of the colleges where he worked, and they didn't know how to get a hold of him. And, you know, I'm thinking I'd really like to talk to him because he's 86 at the time.
I was going to say, he's still here.
He's still here, so I better talk to him fast. One day I was sitting in my office at my cubicle at United Way, which is where I work in the fall. And I said, I'm going to call Director Assistance. So I did, and I got his phone number. And I called him up, and I said, hello, Mr. Duberman. My name is Joanne Williams, and I'm producing a documentary film about a student exchange based on your play in White America. And he said, oh, really? That's great. I said, can I come and interview you? He said, sure. So we did. And this is a long answer to your short question. But my cinematographer and I, Ross Monagle, went to New York. And Duberman was, you know, kind of blustery. Well, I can only talk to you for like 45 minutes. I don't have a lot of time. I said, fine, whatever you can give us, we'll be happy to take it. We went to his apartment. 3.5 hours later.
How did I know that was going to happen? Yeah.
It did. We had this wonderful interview with him and came back to Milwaukee with that. And then he said, well, I'll send you the new material that I wrote for the new production. He said, I wrote a new ending and some new dialogue. I said, okay. He sent that to me. I gave it to the kids at Rufus King for their production. He wrote a new section about Paul Robeson, which was not in the original play. He wrote a new ending to the play, and they used that in their production in 2016. So I said, well, I got to go back to Kaukauna because they're half the story. So I went up to Kaukauna, and we sort of got the superintendent in the lobby and told him about the story, and he said, this is very interesting. I didn't know about this. I want to know more about this. And I said, well, we'll be happy to tell you. So he put us on the agenda of another school board meeting. Subsequently, we went back up, and I talked to the school board. I told them the idea. They all said, interesting. I asked if any of them remembered, or if they knew somebody who remembered, or if they knew somebody who remembered. And some of them said, I don't know, maybe I'll ask around. And that's how I got connected in Kaukauna. And I've been up to Kaukauna many times since then to meet more people. At that meeting, an English teacher, Amy Zhang, who teaches at Kakana High School, was listening to what I said. I didn't know her. I didn't know the people who were in the audience. And in 2017, they got in touch with me again and said, can you send us a copy of the play? So I sent them a script. And then Amy got back to me and said, we want to have the kids come up here and do the play again in Kakana. I said, good. You know, I was very cool about it. That's wonderful, good. And I'm going, yes, 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 yes. So in April of 2018, most of the original cast from the 2016 production, with some additions, because some of these kids had graduated.
And they'd left. Yeah.
And they were gone.
Yeah.
They went up to Kakana and did two performances, one for the sophomore class of Kakana High School, which they were studying American history. That was part of their curriculum. So Amy thought that they would be the best group to see it. So they did one performance as an in-hand reading for the sophomore class. Then they did a second performance that night for the public. And the best part about that was there were people in the audience who had been there in 1966. There were parents there of the original students who were in their 90s.
Oh, my gosh.
There were teachers there who had been there in 1966. One of the exchange students who I'd been trying to find for 2 years came to the show. The sister of one of the other exchange students came to the show. And the best part was Bernie Huppert's, the teacher who brought the two teachers together, came to the show. And he got up on stage and explained how he brought them together and how this was such a controversial event in 1966, and sort of did an introduction to the show that was seen in 2018. So we shot everything. By the time we got to the point where we finished shooting in Kakana, we realized this wasn't going to be 30 minutes. This was more like 90 minutes. Because the film comes in, as I visualize it now, in three chapters. First, the exchange. Then, 50 years later. Then, back to Kakana.
And we do that full circle
mm-hmm.
in about 52 years.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And what's so interesting to me is someone who would have, in 1966, I would have been in grade school and was certainly aware of what was going on with the civil rights movement and what was happening in Vietnam and all of the things that kind of made the 60s the cauldron that it was. And you think about what was happening then and you think about what's happening now, and they are not so different.
No.
Unfortunately, and maybe fortunately too, in a way that people are still making those efforts to make those connections, to break down the barriers. But unfortunately, the barriers are still there.
One of the goals I have for this film is to show that race relations can work, or an improvement in race relations can work, but it's most successful one-on-one. If you have a big demonstration and scream and yell and make a lot of noise, people hear you. But as we've seen over the course of 50 years, things don't change that much. But if you can get somebody in the silence of a theater to see a play, to listen to the history of the United States that you didn't know about, that will have a greater impact than seeing a big demonstration. We also shot the talkbacks after the performances, which were wonderful, where the audience members asked questions, gave us their feelings about what they had heard. And hopefully we will open some doors of communication through this intimate medium of theater and film. You get people together in a big darkened room to watch something artistic, and their way of thinking can be changed. So that's one of the goals with this film, is to tell the story of the exchange and the play and make people think, maybe there is some hope. I didn't realize these things had happened. And look how well these kids got along between these two high schools. Maybe it's possible.
When can we see it? That's what I want to know, because I've seen trailers. You sent me some Vimeo of trailers, and it looks wonderful from a history standpoint, of course, but also just these people are fascinating. And I want to know more about them just from the 3 and 4 minute, you know, trailers that I've seen. So when do you hope to have this available for all of us to see it?
I had great hopes that it would be finished in time for the 2019 Milwaukee Film Festival. I haven't given up on those hopes, but there's a whole lot of work that still has to be done. We're just barely starting to edit. I'm still working on logging and writing. Once we get into the editing process and get the film where we feel that it's ready for post-production, which means color correction and sound and all the enhancements that go into making a film, that's another couple of months. So that's why it says on my flyer, coming in 2019. I am determined that it will be finished in 2019. You will be able to see it this year. I can't tell you exactly what month or what day, but it will be 2019.
Excellent. Well, when that happens, when you have a firm date, come back.
Oh, I will.
And we will talk about the finished film.
I will.
Because you're still in the middle of the journey.
I am. I'm still in it. I'm still deeply in it. Like, I'm glad we had that really cold weather, because that gave me 2 days to just sit there with my laptop and my clips and my external hard drive and write and think and look at what I have. So I'm grateful for that. When the weather starts getting better, I'm going to be tempted to go outside.
No.
Okay.
No.
All right.
You must. You must get it finished because we want to see it.
I must.
Such a great story. And Joanne, I can't believe I've not had you on the show before. We'll have to find other reasons for you to come on and chat with us.
Absolutely. I can talk about the film. I can talk about Black Nouveau.
Yes.
I can talk about...
You can do all of those things.
Yes.
But now you have to go back and go log some film.
I do.
Log some film.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be the reason you didn't get this done. Thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Joanne Williams is the host of Black Nouveau on Milwaukee PBS and the producer of the film Kakana and King. She first spoke with us in March. You can see a preview of the documentary at WUWM.com. That's all for today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
It is 11 o'clock.